This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program: a new era for Israel's Labour Party. Jewish News' foreign editor Michael Daventry speaks to their new leader, Merav Mikhaeli. Holocaust researcher Dr. Stephen Ankia tells us why he is calling for a public inquiry into evidence that suggests a British intelligence enlisted the help of known Nazis and possibly shielded them from justice. Neil Martin, OBE, CEO of JLGB and the chair of Yom HaShoah UK, gives us a preview of the second online memorial event to mark the Jewish Day of Commemoration for the Holocaust. But first, it's time for a look at your copy of the Jewish News, and joining me to go through it this week is news editor Justin Cohen and brand new community editor for the Jewish News, Josh Salisbury. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Now, let's have a look, first of all, at the front page. And, oh, could it be true? This is a nice thought. In shul for Shavuot, zero weekly Jewish COVID deaths recorded for first time. That's a very promising headline to read.
It is very promising. We don't in the piece say we will be in shul for Shavuot. We have got no proof of that at this point, but we are basing this headline on an optimistic interpretation of this week's news, which was that for the first time in 53 weeks, there are no reported COVID deaths in our community, across all sectors of the community, that is. And that's something which I remember the dark days of last March, April, May, and thinking, you know, how huge those numbers were and how it felt never ending. I remember receiving that weekly, or actually a daily email the Board of Deputies used to put out on the numbers because they were so high. And I used to dread that moment at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's wonderful to see. This pandemic is clearly not over yet. Nationally, the numbers are coming down, and we would have expected to see the simultaneous fall in the communal figures. But yeah, as I said, this time last year around Pesach, 127 deaths in 1 week, now zero.
And it is so hugely, it's obviously horrific for those who, just for the record, I have known people who have lost their lives to COVID. So make no mistake, I'm not immune from the feeling of loss during this pandemic. But there is something really quite hopeful about looking at that headline, looking at the sub-headline in particular, that just means, could it be that we are possibly, hopefully, looking at the other side of this before long?
I would just say it's not the only piece of positive and encouraging news in this week's paper related to the pandemic. We also report on the fact that nearly 90% of over 70s in the community have also turned up for their jabs. And that is, again, roughly in line with the national figures. But given the concern about other minority communities and the level of concern in those other communities, this is very promising indeed.
And Justin, you didn't even have to be over 70 to get yours this week.
No, we don't talk about that, Phil.
Yeah.
like everyone on this call, in fact, I've had a bit of a reaction. And like everyone else, I'm hoping it'll just be 24 or 48 hours. But I'm about 20 hours in now.
I want it known for the record. Justin is muddling through in the name of this podcast, and we're grateful for you for doing that. Let's turn to page four, though. And obviously, we issue a speedy recovery, needless to say. On page four, historians seek inquiry.
Yes, so this is a story that follows on from our front page story last week, which was studying this case of a alleged war criminal, Stanislaw Konowski, who was alleged to have murdered Jewish people in the town of Slonim, Belarus, and was then also alleged to have been recruited by MI6 as a spy in the aftermath of the war. And this week we spoke to some historians who raised concerns about the level of secrecy involved in the MI6 files that might shed light on this alleged recruitment of war criminals. And they were calling for these files to be made public and to be made more transparent.
And now, I don't think anyone would have escaped if they listened to this podcast regularly, but hang on a second, Josh, you sound like a new voice. Well, we're not going to let that pass, are we? You are, of course, relatively a newcomer to the Jewish News team, so welcome, and thank you very much indeed as well for daring so soon to venture onto the podcast as well.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah, but best of luck, obviously, as a new community editor. That's very exciting. And of course, I'm sure we will find out as the weeks progress more about that. But let's turn now to page 7, where the headline there reads, Students Reject IHRA.
This is a story about students at City University London who have voted to reject the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism in a campus-wide referendum. So they recommended to the university that the university shouldn't adopt this definition of anti-Semitism, despite campaigns from the Union of Jewish Students and from other communal organisations that the definition should be adopted. It's the latest sort of controversy around adopting the definition and universities up and down the country.
And Justin, one would assume that this could be quite a worrying sign. Okay, it's one university that this is the case with, possibly one of a few, who knows? But the point is, the fact that the students have openly rejected the definition when so many other countries and organizations around the world have, shall we say, happily adopted it, is possibly quite a worrying glimpse into the future leaders of this world.
Unfortunately, this isn't entirely surprising. It's obviously, students aren't known to be anything other than slightly leaning towards the left, and I think that remains the case as it's ever been. Unfortunately, it does seem that these students have fallen under the spell of a lot of propaganda that's coming from the far left, from people who still would align themselves with Jeremy Corbyn. And that, remember, is despite the fact that Corbyn himself accepted this definition, albeit under quite significant duress. But for me, this just comes down to one thing. If the black community or if another minority community put forward its own definition and said that we feel that this is anti-Semitic, I mean, it's the McPherson principle, then that should be accepted. But once again, we're seeing a group of students here, unfortunately, probably not the last time, thinking they know better.
What has the university or any of the bodies said in response to this?
The Students' Union has come back and said that they recognise the existence of anti-Semitism in Britain and on campus generally, and they recognise it's a contentious issue and that they're working to support all members of the community, whatever their views are on the topic.
Righto. Let's turn to page 14 now, and the headline there reads, Sacks honoured at White House. Could this be the late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks?
It is indeed. I felt quite honoured for a period of 2 hours last Thursday when I received an email invitation with the famous White House crest inviting me to the first ever virtual Pesach Seder held by, of course, the first ever Jewish second gentleman. When I logged in, of course, I did so and realised that there were nearly 10,000 other people on this call, so I started to feel a little less honoured. But it was a wonderful occasion and a really historic moment. And Lord Sacks and also Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both of whom we've lost in the last year, both massive figures within the communities in America and in the UK and across the board. And they both were remembered with quotes, appropriate quotes about the importance of freedom. And we also heard from the head of the COVID response person at the White House, again, talking about the very relevant themes of, you know, last year we were stuck in our homes, this year we're stuck in our homes, but next year there is a realistic hope that we'll either be in Jerusalem or somewhere nearer to home, but either way, with our families, with our friends and so on. The other thing I would just say to this, it really struck me, at the end of the service, which was about an hour long, Kamala Harris joined her husband, and the warmth, the affection in public that they were willing to show, it was perfectly acceptable for a family audience, but it was really quite a special moment, I thought, and something that I would never expect to see, or certainly I've never seen, from a UK politician and their spouse. It was rather lovely.
Well, might I suggest, Justin, that I can only assume that if you're one of 10,000 and you wanted to feel a little bit better, I can only hope that I was 10,001, because I don't recall such an invitation. But all the same, sounds fascinating. Jolly good stuff. That's on page 14. I'm afraid that is all we have time for a look at the paper for this week. But if you are isolating at the moment, if you cannot get out of the house for whatever reason and you want to get your copy of the Jewish News, then do not forget, you can always read the full paper as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. But for now, news editor Justin Cohen and community editor Josh Salisbury, thank you both very much indeed.
Chag Sameach, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, Israel's Labour Party is the movement that established the State of Israel nearly 73 years ago, but its fortunes have been declining in recent years. Before last week's election, there were fears among its supporters that it may not attract enough votes to win any seats at all in the Knesset. In the event, a dynamic performance from new leader Merav Mikeli, the party's fourth leader in as many years, helped it return to Israel's parliament with a relatively comfortable seven seats. Our foreign editor Michael Daventry spoke to her this week and began by asking her if she was relieved by the election result.
No, it's not a relief. I am happy that I managed to get Labour re-elected to the Knesset, because there was a very clear and tangible danger of Labour disappearing, being erased. And there was a very, very clear option that the note that says Emet, the letters of Labour, will not appear in the polls this year. So I am really overjoyed, and I feel privileged that my fight for reviving Labour and keeping it, and not only keeping it, but restarting the rehabilitation and the rebuilding of the political power on the centre-left through Labour, is succeeding so far. And this is the big news.
We could see your relief. I was watching you on election night when you were giving your victory speech, and you said something that I thought was quite striking. Forgive me for paraphrasing me, but you said they managed to murder Yitzhak Rabin, but they cannot murder his path. Lots of political commentators looking at Israel will say that Israel is becoming a more conservative, a more right-wing country. How are you planning to reverse that?
Well, when you ask Israelis about the positions on the issues, regardless from the political representation or from the symbols that people are speaking about, but when you ask them what do they actually want in their lives in Israel, you are maybe amazed, some are amazed, to find out that the overwhelming majority of Israelis are interested in pluralism, in equality, in freedom of religion, obviously in a welfare state with a just society and a humane economy, all of the above, and even a small majority, it is small, but it's still a majority, supports the two-state solution. But the majority does not believe that it's achievable, which is quite rational for them, but there's still support for the two-state solution. And there's this disconnect between Israelis and their political representation that has been growing slowly but surely during the Netanyahu era. So the first and mandatory requirement to start changing this reality is to replace Netanyahu as prime minister. And then, as I said, at the same time, start rehabilitating and rebuilding the political power on the center left that was crushed and devastated altogether. And we need to gain people's trust in us as the representatives of what they want to actually see in their day-to-day lives and in their politics. So this is the task. This is what I have taken on. This is what I am committed to. And I have many, many, many partners for this.
So given that disconnect and given the need, as you say, to rehabilitate, you've got quite an important meeting next week with the president, and he's going to be asking you who your recommendation, who Israeli Labour's recommendation is for prime minister. Who will you be recommending?
Well, I will not be there in person, but my faction members will recommend Yair Lapid, who is the head of the largest party in the non-Netanyahu bloc, as much as there is such a bloc. And hopefully we can. And God knows I'm working behind the scenes and I'm stating on every possible protocol that making every effort to find a way to form a government that will replace Netanyahu is certainly what I'm very much invested in.
Do those every ways, all of those possibilities, does that include the possibility of supporting a government, anti-Netanyahu government led by Naftali Bennett?
I still don't know that this is a viable option because Naftali Bennett has not yet stated that he's up for it, that he's ready to be a prime minister of such a non-Netanyahu bloc. So I don't know that there is such a possibility. Certainly, Naftali Bennett is not my preferred candidate for prime minister. But as we said, we are committed to making every effort to replace Netanyahu. And it's too soon to tell what it will take, but we are working on it.
It doesn't sound to me like you're ruling it out, though.
I cannot, and I said during the campaign, I cannot rule it out altogether. Because if, I don't know, in some way this is the only way to make it happen, then maybe, yes, maybe we will have to be part of such a government. But it's, as I said, too soon to tell. And I don't even know yet formally that Naftali Bennett is really in on it.
So for progressives in Israel and for supporters of Israel who consider themselves to be politically progressive, this has been a disappointing election in terms of the representation of women in parliament. There are, by my count, 29 MKs, and that's down on the last election. So fewer than a quarter of members of the Knesset are now women. Is it the time, would you say, to start introducing mandatory minimum quotas for women on party shortlists?
I think it was the time already a long time ago. I have a legislation proposal that does exactly that, that puts it as a mandatory qualification for every party that wants to run to the Knesset to have at least 40% representation for every sex on every fifth. I mean, on every five in the list, in every five on the list. But of course, it was voted down by Netanyahu's coalition because we still have two ultra-Orthodox religious parties who would not let women be represented on them at all. And they have this kind of veto on that, or at least used to have. But moreover, I don't see Netanyahu, I don't see the rest of the right-wing parties in the Knesset so thrilled to have to fulfill such a requirement. The truth of the matter is that in Israel, since it's only been around for 73 years, and that was after the vote, there was an argument in the early days before the beginning of the State of Israel. There was an argument here between the different parties about whether women should or should not vote. Thankfully, the progressives then have won, but it's as if the conservative or orthodox forces have not given up on the objection for equality, gender equality, and equality among people at all. And since the settlers, especially, of course, the religious, masochistic settlers, have political power that is way, way, way stronger than their actual part in the population, unfortunately, they managed to wage a major backlash for the feminist achievements that we have had during the last, maybe the 20 years before the last 5 years in which we are fighting against this backlash. Actually, only today, one of the representatives that Netanyahu managed to get in, one of the extreme right representatives in Smotrich's party, they introduced their demands, one of them being a cancellation of a government resolution that demands every institution in the country to work according to UN Security Council Resolution 1325. And that is actually protection on women. So they want to cancel measures of protection on women and children regarding violence. That is how far we've gone with the backlash. But I am positive the women in Israel have no intention of accepting that.
I just wonder whether or not a 40% quota is something that needs to be introduced as a snap decision, or whether or not, given the difficulties that the ultra-Orthodox and strictly Orthodox people have in accepting this, that there needs to be some kind of transition period? Or do you think it just needs to be a quick flip and say, right, now is the time, let's go?
There's always the time. There's never a bad time to introduce the demand for equality. And what I did, I was elected chair of Labour 8 weeks ago, I think. And the first decision that I made was that the list of Labour that went to primaries a week from my election will be, every other seat will be man or woman. So this is, the list is completely egalitarian. I made this decision, and you could see that in the primaries, we hardly needed to make any corrections in the list because people knew it was going to be that way, egalitarian, and they voted egalitarianly, almost completely. So this change is like, it's, the public is completely ready for that. There is a genuine understanding of equality and certainly gender equality in Israel's population and public. The only thing standing between us is a very small, but without any proportion, a strong and powerful force in politics that prevents us from doing it. So hopefully, if there is a government without those conservative and archaic forces, certainly it's the time to do this.
I'm going to take it to British politics, if I may. Your predecessor but one, Avi Gabay, broke its ties with the British Labour Party because of the British Labour Party's leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and the way that he was leading the party there. You had a conversation with the new leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, just a few days before the election, I believe. I'm curious, seeing as ties between Israeli and British Labour seem to have been re-established, what did you think of Keir Starmer? How do you feel about progress under his leadership in British Labour?
Wow, I don't want to hand out, you know, grades to anyone else. I never do, but I am very, very keen to have a cooperation about, because I think our two, and I said that to him on our conversation, both of our parties have a profound and interesting way of updating themselves and taking back the mission of building a just society in our countries. And I look forward to this cooperation and to the mutual learning that we can achieve.
What did you think of him?
I had a very, very nice conversation with him. It wasn't very long because it was during the campaign. I had a very good impression of him. And as I said, I look forward to our future cooperation.
The new leader of Israel's Labour Party, Merav Mikeli, speaking to foreign editor Michael Daventry there. This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, Jewish leaders have called for a public inquiry into claims British intelligence may have recruited suspected Nazi war criminals and shielded them from justice. The shocking allegations were aired in a BBC investigation into the case of suspected Nazi murderer Stanislav Chernovsky, who is alleged to have possibly been recruited for intelligence work in the aftermath of war. Well, joining me now to look into this particular and extraordinary story further is Dr. Stephen Ankia, who's a Holocaust researcher and also is amongst the people who is gathering research for evidence. And I am delighted to say, not so delighted with the subject, but delighted to say he joins us on the Jewish News Podcast now. Stephen, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed for your time and for speaking to me on this episode of the Jewish News Podcast. This just sounds, I don't want to trivialize such a serious subject, but I can only describe this as sounding like the Twilight Zone. How on earth is this even something that's happened?
Well, after the war, there was a shortage of labor in the United Kingdom. And because of that, there were certain schemes set up to bring men in particular, but also women, into this country to help with this shortage. It was called the European Voluntary Workers System. There were also a number of men who came into this country who had changed sides at the end of the war or had lied when they were asked to give an account of what they had done in the war, or they were prisoners of war, and the authorities in this country did not want to send them back to the Soviets, where they would have probably been killed. In this particular case, Stanislav Shinovsky was in Slonim. He was an auxiliary voluntary policeman. He was alleged to have been involved in several murders. And when the Russians were moving westward, he fled from Slonim and joined the what was called the Siegling Brigade. And then he joined, with a number of others, I would add, the 30th Grenadier Weapon Division of the SS. And they moved to France, where they surrendered to either the Maquis or the Americans, and then they were transferred to the British. When they came under British control, they were put into what was known as the Polish Second Corps and were part of the British Army. And after the war, they were all brought over here in 1946. And in 1947, many of them were discharged or demobbed into civilian life. So that should have been the end of it. The next thing that happened was that Shinovsky had a stepson, and he was very abusive to this stepson, and all sorts of nightmares were recalled by the son when he decided to report him to the war crimes inquiry in the 80s. Nothing much happened at that point.
You see, Stephen, the thing is that this sounds like I obviously one would expect it. It's the subject that you look at very closely, but this sounds like that this sort of activity was almost common knowledge, but yet it's not common knowledge to the wider public, who obviously sort of, I think, have a fair understanding, certainly from my perspective anyway, have a wider understanding of what happened pre, post, and during World War II and the Holocaust in particular. But I'm not overly familiar with this aspect of things. So does this mean that there are other individuals who could have also have been in a similar situation and would have just almost, as it were, slipped through the net into British society?
I have absolutely no doubt at all that there were several. I have personally identified some myself, and some of my researchers also identified some through looking at information in the archives. I think that all of this is a very serious scandal. I think there is a need for some sort of an inquiry on at least two different levels. The first one is that the CPS decided not to prosecute Stanislav Shinovsky, even although the police had provided a report on him. And I would like the Justice Committee, that's the parliamentary committee, to look at the evidence for that. That what they said, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, said that there were too few credible witnesses, which is somewhat incredible. There were two very good witnesses who knew about his activity. I would like to know how many other witnesses there were that we don't know about, and whether the police ever went to Slonim to investigate further, and if they did, what they found.
But of course, there will be some people who hear your cries for this, and I know that it's not just you, by the way, and I'm well aware that there are many other prominent Jewish figures who are calling for some sort of public inquiry into this, as I said in my introduction. But there will be some people who think, well, what's the point? I mean, Shinovsky assumedly is long dead. So he certainly isn't around anymore. But what could this possibly do by having an inquiry? And even if the findings are unpalatable, which by all accounts they may well be, what's going to be achieved from it?
Well, first of all, it's a scandal. We need to know who's responsible for it. And there is no doubt in my mind that there is a big possibility that there could be other people like Stanislav Shinovsky still alive, and they should be pursued to the grave, bearing in mind the terrible things that they did. So I would like to see an inquiry as to what the police and the CPS did, and whether it can be combined or not. I would like to see some sort of an inquiry into whether or not he was given an amnesty for the work that he did, gathering intelligence work in Berlin in 1954. You probably know we got some very interesting video evidence that he was there. But he wasn't a British subject at the time. He didn't have a British passport. How did he get there? The only way he could have got there was on government business. So that's an intelligence and security committee matter that I would like to see investigated.
Well, I should say at this stage that a Home Office spokesperson didn't answer questions from the Jewish News on whether or not sort of any documents pertaining to this particular case were destroyed or not because of the War Crimes Act. But of course, you know, we do absolutely want to hear whatever official may have to say on this. Stephen, the only thing I could ask that is that you would be so kind as to keep us posted here at the Jewish News and the Jewish News podcast as to how you progress with this.
One thing which is also relevant to all of this, the authorities did get one conviction of Anton Savonia, and he went to prison. He was a Nazi collaborator and a killer. Now, I would like to know whether once the authorities had got that specimen conviction in the bag, that they thought, well, we're not going to pursue any of the other people who were around at the time. And soon afterwards, actually, they closed the war crimes unit. That was in 1999. And just before Savonia was finally found guilty, the CPS put out an extraordinary briefing to the newspapers to say that they would only prosecute people who had command responsibility. Now, command responsibility means that you have subordinates and you tell them what to do, and therefore you have added responsibility. Now, the point about this is that is not in the War Crimes Act of 1991. And it kind of adds to the feeling that what was going on was that they didn't want to know. The authorities did not want to know any more after they had got their specimen conviction. And if you recall back to those days, the IRA was still extremely active. And it may be that the authorities, the security authorities, were overstretched, and it had cost a lot of money to get Savonia prosecuted, and they wanted out. I should add that this was, I think, slightly before Islamic terrorists started their work, although they may have had some heads up that this was on its way. But I think, and I would like to know, if that was the reason they never prosecuted Chernovsky and several others. There were several others who were very good candidates to be prosecuted.
Well, obviously, I dare suggest that, unfortunately, there are some questions there that simply can't be answered unless Home Office officials care to do that for us, and they are most welcome to do so at any time here on the Jewish News podcast, and indeed for the Jewish News. But in the meantime, I have no doubt that Dr. Stephen Ankia, you will get to the bottom of this on behalf of all us, for which we are incredibly grateful. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News podcast.
Thank you very much.
This is the Jewish News podcast, in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, Yom HaShoah is nearly upon us. Obviously, it comes very soon, or around the time of Pesach. We're in the middle of Pesach. So naturally, as we are all coming to terms with yet another Passover in a lockdown situation, well, naturally, events that follow must also be in a similar guise. Joining me now is the chair of Yom HaShoah UK, who also happens to be the CEO of the JLGB, Neil Martin OBE. And Neil, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News podcast. If I may start off first by asking just, well, I would say what's going to be different this year, but of course it's not, because it was the same last year, really, isn't it? You know, we were rather hoping that last year's virtual event for Yom HaShoah might be the only one, and alas, here we are.
Very much so. We pulled out all the stops last year with about 3 weeks' notice, and we were the first ever communal virtual event and set the standard proudly so, but had no intention or hope to ever have to do it ever again. And how do you repeat, how do you better last year? And the honest truth is you can't. But what you have to remember is the subject matter. You have to think about the circumstances we're in now and how we get the audience and get the community to watch a ceremony. And the answer is you've got to put in that what will resonate with people in terms of understanding why it's still important, no matter the circumstances, no matter what we're under now, which is nothing like what the survivors and refugees and all those who were murdered had, that we have to remember regardless. And so we're doing all we can to make it the best it can be, the most poignant it can be. But there's no topping of it, if that makes sense. It's just, it is what it is, and it's important that people remember.
But you know, I was thinking to myself not so long ago, actually, that although you're quite right when you say we can't possibly compare what we're going through now to what victims of the Holocaust went through, there is just no comparison. But what this is it's probably the first time many of us in our lifetimes have experienced such disruption to day-to-day life that we took so much for granted until this point of COVID pandemic. And what it's done for me, and I hope potentially for others, and it'd be interesting to see whether or not if you've experienced this or you know of people who have gone through the same, is whether or not it gives us a newfound appreciation for what we have. Maybe it was getting to a stage where we took a little too much for granted life we had and the freedom we had before the pandemic struck.
I think it's very difficult. I think first and foremost, there is nothing that compares to the unimaginable horrors of the Holocaust, full stop. And we have to be very, very careful. And we work very carefully ourselves not to make the connection too strong, because it's not right. However, as you say, none of us have experienced what we're going through now in the last 70 plus years in terms of a nation in lockdown and what's been going on. Of course, we've seen the spirit of volunteering, that blitz-like mentality and how people are working together. And we've sadly seen the loss of life as well. So I think it has given appreciation of what we've been going through. But I think what Yom HaShoah helps us to realize is it gives us a sense of perspective as to what we're going through. And it depends, of course, as to families, because many families have lost people in the last year as well. But in terms of actually living at home, homeschooling has been difficult, obviously. We've got Zoom technology. But what we're going through now is nothing in comparison to. But it has, and it did last year as well, bring the community together. And it has also allowed us to use hybrid models and technology to actually get probably more people commemorated Yom HaShoah last year than did when it was face-to-face. So it's amazing what the positives that can come out of circumstance is. It has been quite, we've built on that this year, especially so.
Now, you've alluded to this already, but of course, last year you had a matter of weeks to scramble everything together for what would have been an in-person event, changing it to online. This year, obviously, I would like to think you've had a little bit longer to prepare. So does that mean that this is more the event that you had in mind this time round, because it would have been tailored for such circumstances? And if so, what's different?
If only it was so easy. I think that it's, if you go back to November, December, we thought we might be coming out of this pandemic. And of course, just before the end of the year, we went back into it and locked down again in January. So actually, organizing something in the last few months in lockdown when schools haven't been running, etc., and we're actually more restricted. And of course, after a year of everyone being in lockdown and fatigue setting in, and how many different things can people contribute to? How many times can you ask people to go onto Zoom? How many times can kids do a variety of things, schools taking over lessons, etc.? The actual circumstances are potentially harder now. The adrenaline of getting it ready a year ago, and of course, most importantly, I want people to watch and be part of Wednesday's thing. It's going to be really, really good, and I'll tell you more about it in a second of what's happening, but it's going to be exactly what it needs to be in that sense. But the adrenaline of last year with 3 weeks to go and getting it ready is very different to here, where we thought we might actually be able to achieve some kind of hybrid commemoration. But as we got to December, it became the reality of what we'd be able to do. So actually, it's about the same amount of time, really. And of course, with the Jewish calendar as it falls, Yom HaShoah is a bit earlier this year than last year.
Well, you've teased us enough. So let us find out what will happen on Wednesday evening.
So I think there's two really important things to highlight. One is using, as I said before, the advantage of technology. So one of the great things we've got four different survivors and refugees giving their testimony. What we're actually doing is they're being interviewed by their own grandchildren via Zoom and then edited together. So many of these survivors and refugees haven't seen their grandchildren for a year face to face, and many of them wanted to still educate on the Holocaust in the last year, etc. So we brought them together in a series of things where not only is it firsthand testimony, but it's young people inquiring and finding out about the stories of their own family. And I think that's going to be very, very special. And they talk, of course, about what they miss at the moment and what they're looking forward to see as well. And importantly, the life they've made in the UK phenomenally in the last 76 years. And then secondly, in conjunction with the Maccabi Yellow Candle Project, we really have a truly national event on Wednesday. So often a national event that's face-to-face in London, for example, isn't always accessible to everyone from Glasgow and Leeds and Newcastle and Brighton, etc. But online, you can involve everybody. And so we have representatives and candlelighters from all across the world, actually. But we've got Glasgow, we've got Belfast, we've got Brighton, we've got Bournemouth, we've got Liverpool, Merseyside, Manchester, Cardiff, etc. Every representation of the community. We've got first, second and third and fourth generation survivors lighting candles. We've got almost every charity in the Jewish community lighting a candle. So the main thing about next Wednesday is the entire UK Jewish community will stop and will pause and together in unison light a candle. And many people, it's not too late if you go to the Macabre Yellow Candle website to get your own candle to light in unison at home. And I think that'd be very, very powerful and just juxtaposes. And what we've tried to do this year is take the situation we're in now and then use the togetherness to unite our community as we remember the greatest tragedy in our history.
As a wise person has said to me in the last year, it's almost like we're coming together apart is the only best way of describing it. You have written a rather splendid article on page 20 of this week's Jewish News, so please do make sure you have a read of that. And just finally, Neil, if anyone wants any more information on the event that is happening on Wednesday evening, where do they need to go?
So it's live 7:30 p.m. You can, first and foremost, the best place to watch this, because people don't realize this necessarily, is if you've got a smart TV, get your YouTube app up and in the search thing just write Yom HaShoah UK. Then you can watch the whole ceremony on your big screen TV. If that's too technological for some people, then on your mobile phone, your laptop, your tablet, etc., your desktop computer, go to yomashoah.org.uk and it's the YouTube video will be live embedded in that screen. It's there now. And you can watch it also on, we're streaming live on many, many charities' Facebook pages as well. So you can watch it anywhere throughout the community, simulcast all over the country, all over the world, in fact.
We haven't even had time to discuss JLGB's involvement in this, but frankly, I'm afraid you'll just have to read the article, or possibly we'll have to get you back on. Neil Martin, OBE, CEO of JLGB and chair of Yom HaShoah UK, thank you so much for everything that you do for the community, and thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News podcast.
Thanks so much, Phil.
And that's it. Thank you very much indeed for listening to this edition of the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. For more information, you can always visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to our guests, to Merav Mikeli, speaking to Michael Daventry, also Dr. Stephen Ankia and Neil Martin, OBE. And of course, must also say thank you to our paper review team, Justin Cohen and Josh Salisbury. And also to Justin for producing this episode of the Jewish News podcast. Please do remember to subscribe to us in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new ones become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you. You can always email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.